Now, for your summer reading pleasure, a bevy of independent booksellers around the country are offering a bevy of book suggestions on matters that range from B for bread to Z for zany. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg says this strange literary alphabet contains wisdom and some good laughs.
Big laughs in Brady Udall's new book, The Lonely Polygamist. Daniel Golden, proprietor of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, says this big novel is the story of an evangelical LDS father and his big family.
Four wives and 28 children strong.
Rona Brindley, owner of the Bookmark in Atlantic Beach, Florida, also puts The Lonely Polygamist on her summer reading list. Rona says the busy father is henpecked, hapless, and in a good bit of trouble.
This is a man whose life is not going well. Everything is kind of falling apart in his business, and the only job he can get is to build a brothel called Pussycat Manor in Nevada. And he can't really tell his four wives that that's what he's doing, so he's telling them that he's building an old age home. And one of them actually comes to find them and says to him, not why are you building a brothel, but why would anybody want to build an old age home next to a brothel?
At 600 pages, this novel sounds like Big Fat Big Love, you know, the HBO series about polygamy. There is more largesse in one of book buyer Lucia Silva's choices. She works for Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California. In Big Machine, novelist Victor Lavoll tells the tale of Ricky Rice, who grew up in an evangelical Christian cult. He's an ex-druggie janitor who joins a group of unlikely scholars at some mysterious backwoods Vermont library. Lucia says the scholars are prostitutes, ex-petty criminals, and addicts like Ricky.
And they are faced with these cryptic assignments and baffling protocols and made to dress in three-piece suits and jodhpurs and bowler hats.
This motley crew is instructed to investigate paranormal activities.
And that's about the first 100 pages.
Lucia Silva says the book is very real and at the same time ghostly and weird. Thrillingly weird, she says. Basically, a crazy meditation on faith and doubt. The title, Big Machine, comes from one character's observation.
Doubt is the big machine. It grinds up the delusions of women and men.
Certainty, moral certainty, drives the plot of another summer book pick, this one from Rona Brindley in Florida. It's a novel set on Cape Cod and in Europe during World War II. The Postmistress by Sarah Blake explores what happens if a mail carrier decides not to deliver a letter and a reporter decides not to tell a story.
And all in the name of greater compassion, not for any selfish reasons, but they think it's the right thing to do.
There are ramifications, of course. Rona reads a crucial plot point.
The whole thing relied on never once looking inside an envelope. Iris had never even held a letter up to the light to read the writing there. The whole beauty of the system, the godliness, lay in making sure the trains ran smoothly on the tracks, that letters sent out arrived no matter what was inside. She ought to get on her bicycle and ride up the hill to Emma's house. She ought to go to the door and knock, and when the woman came to answer, she ought to hold out her hand and give the letter over. She ought to do all this, but even as she ought, Iris filled the kettle and set it on the burner and waited. When the whistle blew, she opened the spout, holding the envelope in the current of steam. The envelope came unstuck easily, and she slid out the single sheet of paper.
The radio journalist narrator of The Postmistress also has a story she keeps secret. So, the truth and when to tell it, and the pursuit of secrets. The narrator of another Rona summer pick also hunts for truth. This nonfiction book is called 52 Loaves, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meaning, and a Perfect Crust. Author William Cunningham remembers a luscious loaf of bread he ate once in a restaurant and decides he must recreate it.
And he's going to commit that every week for 1 year he's going to bake a loaf of peasant bread until he gets it right.
Cunningham starts from scratch, that is, he grows the wheat, and that's just the beginning. So, William Cunningham bakes, the narrator of the book Yarn, Remembering the Way Home, knits. Milwaukee bookseller Daniel Golden says Kyoto Mori hasn't written the usual knitting book, but knitting is a key plot-weaving thread.
It is the story of a Japanese woman who's become alienated from her family, moves to the United States to a small city, Green Bay, has a shaky marriage, and tries to reinvent herself and find community in her new home.
Kyoto Mori's book is a memoir. Ander Monson's is definitely not. In fact, Monson's new collection of essays and quirks is called Vanishing Point, Not a Memoir. Lucia Silva of Portrait of a Bookstore is a big fan of this writer.
Ander Monson is this searingly smart guy, but he's not smarty pants.
How smart is he? Well, sounds as if he has a new literary form, a way to mesh real-life paper and ink books with digital.
So he has this paper book, and every so often there are these little symbols, a little dagger that will follow a word. And if you type that word into a page on his website, it will offer you all of this marginalia or footnotes about yet another digression.
The links take you to videos or photographs or various new ruminations. Lucia says it's like inked hyperlinks for the book. Or, in Ander Monson's words,
this is old but good technology, pressed and dried paper pulp bound by glue in your hands and smelling good like something real. Maybe the daggers are more like clickable links, like this whole thing is an expanding wiki, an increasingly fat American self growing and thinking and growing, a ball getting larger and larger. The more I think about it, the more you think about it, the more you and I become we, and we continue thinking about all of this stuff together.
From Vanishing Point, Not a Memoir by Ander Monson. Thanks to Lucia Silva of Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California, Rona Brinley at the Book Mark, Atlantic Beach, Florida, and Daniel Golden at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee for their seasonal literary ideas. Wishing you a bag full of summertime reading pleasure. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You can get the complete lists of recommendations from these booksellers and excerpts from these booksellers and excerpts from all their selections at our website, npr.org.
Try reading a book while doing a crossword puzzle. That, according to Nicholas Carr, describes the intellectual environment of the Internet. Carr is the man who wrote the article in The Atlantic, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And he's now expanded that idea into a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. His point, in a nutshell, is that on the Internet we consume information, well, in a nutshell, lots of nutshells. It's a medium based on the desirability of interruption. And according to Nicholas Carr, it is changing the way we read and conditioning us against the very activities we associate with the acquisition of wisdom, deep reading, solitary concentration. Nicholas Carr joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And first, this is a project that you undertook after noticing something about your own ability to concentrate. Tell us about that.
Well, I'd been, like a lot of people, I've been using the Internet more and more over the years, and certainly have found it hugely beneficial to doing research and all sorts of other things. But a few years ago, around 2007, I noticed that I was basically losing my ability to concentrate. And this was even when I wasn't online. I'd sit down with a book or a long article, and after a couple of pages, you know, my brain wanted to do what it does when I'm online, check email, click on links, do some Googling, hop from page to page. And so that got me looking into what was going on and looking into the science of the brain and how important it is to be able to pay attention and so forth. So this really came out of, originally, out of my own personal experience.
And your argument in the book is that the neuroplasticity of the brain's capacity to adapt to stimuli, to change, means that we don't merely lose concentration as we're reading while surfing, but you would say that we are generally diminishing our power to concentrate as a result of reading while surfing.
That's right. So it follows us, in effect, even when we turn off our computers. And the reason is that over the last few decades, neuroscientists and psychologists have discovered that even as adults, our brains are very plastic. They're very malleable. They adapt at the cellular level to whatever we happen to be doing. And so the more time we spend surfing and skimming and scanning online and multitasking and processing lots of interruptions, the more adept we become at that mode of thinking, but at the same time, we begin to lose the capability to pay attention, to concentrate, to be contemplative and introspective.
You cite many studies in your book that show that reading online yields less comprehension than reading a printed page. But considering how recent a phenomenon reading online is, isn't it possible, at least, that a generation that grows up without the printed page, should there be such a generation, reading everything online, just might grow up much better at doing that than people today, nearly all of us having begun reading books and taken up reading online only very recently, later in life?
I think that's possible. But what you have to remember is that reading online is very different from reading off of a printed page. So even as we might become better hopping between pages and clicking on links and processing many small bits of information, that doesn't mean that we aren't at the same time losing that other slower, more contemplative mode of thought. And in fact, if you look at a lot of recent research on multitasking, it shows that, in fact, as people optimize their ability to multitask online, they become less creative in their thinking. They become more likely to simply process information rather than think deeply for themselves about it. So even if we get better at jumping from bit to bit to bit of information, we're still losing. In fact, we'll probably lose even more that other contemplative, introspective mode of thought.
The idea that the brain in this regard is a kind of zero-sum game, that the ability to check many text messages hitting us and read wiki intros is somehow diminishing our ability to read Moby Dick, is not altogether self-evident. But why shouldn't one be able to become just better at a whole variety of mental, intellectual tasks?
Well, it depends on how much time you spend doing different things. So if, in fact, we spent an hour or two online or an hour and two, sending text messages, and then we shut that off and we spent 3 hours reading Moby Dick, that would be one thing. I think that then the brain is very adept at doing both of those things. But what we're seeing is for most of us, and particularly for young people in their 20s and 30s, being online and doing all the sorts of fun and beneficial things we do when we're online or sending text messages or other messages is crowding out the time that we spend not only reading longer works, but also just sitting and thinking and paying attention and being able to concentrate. So, in fact, we're seeing this medium, the medium of the web, in effect, replace the time that we used to spend in different modes of thinking. And when that happens, that we begin to lose that old ability to concentrate on one thing for, more than 15 seconds.
In every age, there are critics of new technologies. You write about them in the book. There seems to be an inevitable argument on behalf of innovation, whether it is the calculator or whether it is Sesame Street that was full of quick jump cuts and short items that critics said would be distracting and would not build up the attention span of the children who watched it. But it doesn't matter. What is more sophisticated and more technologically savvy inevitably seems to win.
I think that's true, and I'm kind of a fatalist, actually, when it comes to technology. I'm not sure that we can turn back the clock, so to speak. But what you see as well is not just technological progress, but a form of human regress in all of these distractions, because I think our natural state of mind, dating back to when we were cavemen and, had to pay attention to things jumping out of somewhere, is to be distracted, is to constantly shift our attention. And in some ways, the book, just over the last 500 years, made this more contemplative, more attentive mode of thought more popular. And so in some ways, the constant distraction that we are facing with modern media, and I think the computer and the internet are very much in line with other developments in media over the last 100 years, but these in effect return us to that natural state of distractedness. And so what we might come to find out is that this ability we had to be deep, solitary thinkers really was something of an aberration in the great sweep of intellectual history that really just emerged with this technology of the printed page or even the handwritten page, and that might be something that we actually are rushing to get rid of without even thinking about it too much.
Well, Nicholas Carr, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nicholas Carr, the author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. Are books becoming obsolete? You can read Nicholas Carr's prediction in an excerpt from The Shallows at our website, npr.org.
Megan Dom is the author of the recent book, Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House. For our series, You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love, Dom picked a novel with a cast of liberal Manhattan do-gooders. She finds them as compelling as they are thoroughly unlikable.
Just about any writer who's had his or her work dissected in a writing workshop is familiar with the complaint, I simply don't like this character. What they mean is that unlikable characters make for unlikable books. I don't agree. Case in point, Zoe Heller's novel, The Believers. It's infused with so much wit and intelligence that you don't care a bit that it's populated with some jaw-droppingly prickly people. At the center of this bitter goulash is the Litvinov family. There are three grown children, Rosa, Carla, and Lenny. Then there's the sour British expat mother, Audrey, and the father, Joel, a well-known radical lawyer in the William Kunstler mode. Raised in a bubble of lefty intellectualism in Greenwich Village, they attended the Little Red Schoolhouse. They also sat in rapt attention as their father expounded about Marxism over pancakes. Now the kids are struggling to find their own doctrines. Rosa, adrift after living in Cuba for 4 years, has become enamored of Orthodox Judaism. Carla, who's struggling with infertility and married to a humorless union organizer, finds solace in an unlikely sexual dalliance. Meanwhile, Lenny, whom the Litvinovs adopted at 7 in a rather self-congratulatory goodwill gesture, is a heroin addict. The story revolves around Joel, the father. He spends most of the book unresponsive in a hospital bed following a stroke, but his presence, which is to say the residue of his ego, is felt on each page, not least of all through Audrey, who, despite being, like her husband, a proud atheist who had often, Heller writes, shaken her head ruefully at dotty sanctity of life types, insists on keeping him alive through artificial means. Along the way, she also discovers her husband has a longtime mistress with whom he fathered a child. I could tell you more of the plot of The Believers, but it's not what's best about this novel. For me, what's so exhilarating is Heller's ear, not just for her descriptions and dialogue, but for her tough, compassionate observations of human pettiness. I love this exchange between Rosa and Carla after a visit to the apartment of their father's mistress. "Did you take a look at her idiotic books?" "No," Carla lied. "It was all how to read palms and diet books." "Well, you don't love someone because of the books they read." "Don't you?" The Litvinovs aren't just a family. They're a symbol of earnest leftiness, of NPR listenership writ large, of downtown Manhattan as a locus of bohemian idealism. But even though this book is a satire, it's also tender about the ways these family members now find themselves profoundly unmoored. Their solution? To search for ballast in the form of belief systems, to fill the hole left by Joel's imminent death with an equally doctrinaire, if ultimately less loving, set of gospels. The result is a poignant, sometimes outrageous, and very often hilarious novel about the courage, and also the cowardice, of standing by your convictions at all costs.
Megan Dom is the author of Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House. For more You Must Read This essays, reviews, and author interviews, go to npr.org.
Soccer star has been rising here in the U.S., but the sport's not nearly as big here as it is just about everywhere else in the world. If you're among those who think soccer is, a bit boring, writer Cord Jefferson thinks he can change your mind. Here's his contribution to our three-book series, where authors recommend three books on one theme.
As a soccer fanatic, I can't understand why my favorite sport isn't more popular in the United States. One guess is that rarely does it appear on the country's cultural landscape. Sure, Bend It Like Beckham was a breakout hit, but it was no Hoosiers or Bull Durham. Thankfully, some of my favorite authors have been filling in for neglectful screenwriters. Here are three books perfect for convincing American naysayers to tune into World Cup 2010, which begins in South Africa in less than a month. Piggybacking off the success of pop econ book Freakonomics, writer Simon Cooper and economist Stefan Szymanski joined forces for Soccernomics. Unlike baseball fans, soccer supporters are notoriously averse to numbers. That's what makes Cooper and Szymanski's research so important. Using data about seemingly unrelated topics like scoring percentages and racism, the authors piece together fascinating theories about how soccer has evolved and where it's headed. They're so fascinating that you might forget how ugly soccer can be. In the 1980s, journalist Bill Buford immersed himself in the violent, angry, beer-drenched world of British football hooliganism. The book he emerged with, Among the Thugs, is a thorough and often frightening account of the underclass rage that tinges so many soccer rivalries. Buford's darkly humorous writing takes the reader to pubs and stadiums throughout Europe, introducing him to fans who live and die, sometimes literally, by the successes of their teams. In America, our sports are pastimes. Among the Thugs is a reminder that, in soccer cities, their sport is tribal warfare. For all its pockmarks, there's a reason they call soccer the beautiful game. British sports photographer Levon Biss shows us how gorgeous it can be with one love. A collection of soccer photos from 26 countries on 6 continents. From laughing Peruvian women playing in skirts to professionals huddled in prayer in South Africa, Biss's subjects come together under the umbrella of the world's most popular sport. Interspersed with the photographs are quotes from some of soccer's most notable. My favorite is from former Portuguese star Eusebio, who said, "Black or white, we all have football under our skin." Perhaps the main reason soccer is so well loved is because it's easy to play. With just a ball and a few square yards, you've got yourself a game. I believe great art should be similar in scope, something open to everyone who wants to expand their view of the world. The relationship between the two is something serious soccer fans have known for years. To quote the wonderful Hungarian player Ferenc Puskás, "I will write of my life as a footballer as if it were a love story."
Cord Jefferson is a writer and editor. His 3 book suggestions are Soccernomics by Simon Cooper and Stefan Szymanski, Among the Thugs by Bill Buford, and One Love by Levon Biss. For more 3 Books essays, as well as book reviews and interviews with authors, go to npr.org.